and good afternoon, and welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I will be chatting with Chris Cooling, a film professor at the College of Lake County. Chris has been teaching film classes at CLC since 2008. He has also curated a public series of recent international films since 2009. He received his PhD from the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts in 2006, and is here today to discuss Bond, James Bond.
Do I get to talk over this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do I get to feel like this is my introduction music now?
Hey, Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. This is a great honor.
Always great to have you. And boy, that music, when you hear it, the John Barry Orchestra. From the original James Bond movie, Dr. No, and hard to believe that came out in 1962. Mm-hmm. And now, 53 years later, the latest Bond film, Spectre, the 24th official James Bond production in the series, was released this past weekend. And Chris, the music's great, but it can't just be the music. Why has the James Bond series been able to succeed for so many years? What's the what do you think the winning formula is?
I mean, part of me does want to say, yes, it is just the music. The music is that good. I mean, and I say that as a big film score collector and listening to James Bond scores a great deal. A lot of the James Bond movies got me into film music and those early songs and scores. But, of course, you're right. It isn't just the music. It's the beauty of so many wonderful collaborations. John Barry was great. The set design of Ken Adam, if you think back on the giant hidden volcano and the base inside of
that's a
wonderful piece of design. But it's interesting that, I've thought about this question. We've had the idea for the show for a while, and I think that the best answer to that question is how flexible the formula actually is and how much it's been able to adapt and change and absorb other things. In many ways, it seems to be perfected, like a wonderful dish or a souffle when we get a certain combination of the elements. But in many ways, James Bond does grow out of other things, and it responds to the other things that coexist with it, the other media texts and novels and movies. So, for example, this is not my point. A lot of people have pointed out that in the 1970s, Live and Let Die is connected to blaxploitation movies.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's also connected to what sometimes people call Hicksploitation movies, the Burt Reynolds Southern good old boy car chase pictures that we, in addition to having all the African-American characters, we have a redneck Southern sheriff reacting to James Bond. And so in other movies, we'll get, kung fu fighting, we'll get connections to Christopher Nolan movies. And so it seems as if, even though there must be a core element of a spy named James Bond and his gadgets, that really, if you watch the movies, 24 of them over 53 years, you're going to get a variety of options. You can jump in and out and say, I'm in the mood for a genuinely well-plotted serious thriller, and I can go to From Russia with Love. And or you might say, I'm in the mood for a light comedy entertainment, and then you can watch virtually any Roger Moore film, and you're going to have more of a vaudeville show of clowns and outer space lasers and and sometimes I'm in the mood for that,
but it is like taking the souffle metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of McDonald's in there too,
right?
Because
right.
know what you're going to get. You're going to get the Big Mac, and whatever the Big Mac could be, the villain or whatever, and the beautiful Bond girl. Mm-hmm. So it does have these certain elements or formula with each one, even though it does kind of change, like you said.
Right, and that's
reflect the era. It does have that. You know what you're going to get.
But that's the paradox of any type of series like this. It's the paradox of talking about any genre. Any Western film or horror film has to give you things you predict and then things you don't. And so, ideally, when the series is at its best, the thing that you can count on is being surprised, being stunned, being shown some amazing, incredible stunt. Yes, this is a movie about a spy who sleeps with women and travels the world, but I've never seen someone jump off of a ski off the edge of a cliff and then reveal a Union Jack parachute in his backpack. I've never seen a car genuinely eject someone out of it. I've never seen a car do a 360 barrel roll over a Thailand river,
Plus, you're going to get a travelogue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you're going to get to, if you can't travel to those countries, you certainly will in a Bond film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's they're spectacular.
Yeah, for me, I've often felt that in some ways, the formula is trying to give the audience the exciting, unseen new dream vacation that I've almost thought about them as equivalent to, you know, a showcase showdown at the end of The Price is Right, that here's what you're going to get. You're going to get a trip to Egypt, and you're going to sleep with a beautiful woman. And when you're tired of that woman, she'll die. And there will be another beautiful woman, and you'll not think about that last one because you're only moving forward. You know, it's a wonderful, it's an entertaining, but also, of course, complicated depiction of a variety of events and tropes and images. So,
lest we not forget, he is an assassin.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, so I was just looking at, there was an article about kills and killing and all the different ways that he's killed people.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets into the hundreds.
Right.
And very creative ways that he has died. And some of the, we can talk about that as we go on.
Right,
sure.
the need for surprise, right? We know he has a license to kill, and therefore he will kill people. And then the suggestion is, can we find new ways to do that?
Yes.
And so in my memory, I can think of many dramatic drops from great heights, falling off of the backs of airplanes, falling off of the Golden Gate Bridge and screaming, no. And, you know, if we talk about our personal connection, I remember listening to one of the soundtracks to the Bond films, listening to the score and pretending I was in one of the fights myself and clinging to the edge of my bed and thinking, no, I'm going to fall. And then actually falling off of my bed and cracking a mirror in my room and thinking,
no kidding,
I was going to get, you know, bad luck forever, but, you know, for 7 years afterwards. But
for me, Goldfinger, I always fasten my seatbelt, you know, even when the seatbelt signs can go off.
Right, right.
Just because of the scene where Goldfinger himself is sucked out of that plane.
Right.
And it's amazing how just that little thing, you know, I was coming back from a trip a week or two ago, and I just made sure I was clipped up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to do that anyway, but it's extra, you know, I don't want to be like that Goldfinger character, you know, and like you said, falling out of a high altitude.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, surreal image of seeing, you know, this conventional world, or still an idealized world of this private jet. Suddenly, everything falls apart and goes topsy-turvy, and you can get sucked out of the airplane. The fact that he is an assassin with a license to kill reminds us that there's that tension of the formula, that on the one hand, there are travel logs that suggest vacations and leisure, but James Bond also offers us an image of a dream job. It's not just a dream vacation, it's a dream career. You have a boss who sends you around the world, and then your job is to find people that you don't like and kill them.
You know?
You know, technically, the movies do have plots. You know, there are events that occur and reasons why we kill people. But instead, the fantasy seems to be, I'm going to travel the world. There will be available women. I will find myself caught up. There will be easy promiscuity, but also apparently meaningful romance. I will have both, whatever, you know, however they appear in front of me. And the people that I do not like, I have permission to shoot. So it's a fun hypothetical vacation for a lot of people.
Well, it sounds like you've liked most of the 24 films. You've mentioned a few here.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite or one or two favorites out of the whole series of 24?
Right. I mean, there
it's hard to do it. It's almost like different time periods.
Right.
LeBron James and Michael Jordan, and it's kind of hard, you know. Right. Well, go ahead.
Well, I like the fact that you just mentioned, you know, sports figures, because I do think for a lot of people, discussing James Bond movies is kind of equivalent to comparing sports statistics. When was the franchise at its best? What was the best play? What was the best first baseman, second baseman, third baseman? Who was the best M? Who was the best villain? What was the best song?
Hmm.
Is that there's this kind of easy camaraderie and familiarity that the series gives you. You can kind of compare personal notes. So for me, if I'm talking about my personal favorites and I don't care who's listening, I would say they involve the Roger Moore films just because of my age.
No kidding, because most people, you see rankings of James Bond and the actors who did it or portrayed that character, he comes down at the bottom.
He falls out of favor, particularly today, because we're in a Daniel Craig era.
Right.
And Daniel Craig brings gravitas and serious acting chops to the role. But Roger Moore, I can try and justify it, but for a lot of James Bond fans, they would be sympathetic and say, well, Chris likes Roger Moore because he was born in 1974. Roger Moore is the guy he grew up with, and Chris, we forgive you. We understand that. To us, he was a bit silly. If you were properly wise and aged, you would understand that Sean Connery is the best. But we sympathize. You always love your first, and so you're going to have that loyalty, and God bless you. But I'm certainly well aware that From Russia with Love is a genuinely great movie. Goldfinger is a good story, and quite particular and specific if you break it down. It's very quirky in a number of ways. But then also, I love the spy.
Back to Roger Moore, though.
Go ahead.
So besides the time period, was there anything else about Roger Moore that that struck out about you, that he was special?
Well, to give it the context that I think would help justify it is, I was born in 74 and I grew up with his movies as the current movies. And they would be appearing on television as the most exciting new release, ABC Sunday Night Movie. And at the same time, while I was watching television, I was also seeing repeats of Get Smart with Don Adams. And I found that there was not, to me, a clear distinction between the world of Get Smart and the world of Roger Moore James Bond movies. People die horribly in Get Smart, and the Roger Moore James Bond movies were often quite funny. And so to me, that was the formula, that the world of spying is also a world in which you can appear silly and be goofy and clumsy, and that those are characteristics of a masculine figure that can coexist alongside toughness and suavity and seduction and being debonair.
Athleticism. Roger Moore didn't really show.
No, he wasn't necessarily as interested in that. He was more interested in, to me, being a kind of host. In some ways, he's the Shatner of the series, right? that you can compare William Shatner to Patrick Stewart and say, William Shatner might not have that gravitas, but he has immense personal charm, and he kind of, through that charm, is able to maybe ironically comment on the series. Mm-hmm. That he allows it to be okay that the monster that he's fighting is a man in a suit with a styrofoam rock. And James Bond with Roger Moore allows us to say, that's okay that this villain has giant metal teeth. Just go with it. We are in a cartoon world, and I will guide you through it. We are going to experience a vaudeville show of sights and attraction and fun, and I make it okay. I give you permission to allow this to just be what my Uncle Philip would call pure entertainment. That this is just going to be
when people would die, it was almost vaudevillian.
Yes.
Whereas with Daniel Craig, you've been hurt before you die.
Right. He's introduced horribly killing a man desperately in a bathroom without any glamour. And so...
Are you talking about Spectre now?
I'm talking about his first James Bond film, Casino Royale.
Right, right.
Makes a point of establishing that this Daniel Craig James Bond is a human James Bond. He's vulnerable. When someone says, would you like your martini shaken or stirred? He says, do I look like I give a damn?
Exactly.
So there's a sense of, that's the fluidity of the formula, that some of these guys are going to absolutely embrace the artifice and the stylization and the fantasy of it, while others are going to say, we also want you to think about this as connected to the real world somehow. And I think that in some ways gets Daniel Craig into a bit of trouble when he ends up in a film like Spectre, that is trying to be a little bit more like the Roger Moore James Bond films, that is trying to be more stylized and abstract and cartoonish, that it almost seems like a waste of Daniel Craig because he's so grounded and he's so real. And it's a reminder that, yes, there is this formula, but like a souffle, like a great work of cuisine, if you're just a little bit off with a bit of salt, you kind of ruin it. And so, you can have a variety of dishes that you prepare, but you can also screw them up if you're miscalculating the elements.
Well, we've talked about the Bond characters, though you did glide over Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Who he was the original.
It's true.
So he established the character at the very beginning, and then the other actors could kind of depart from that. So you got to give him his due, I think, for that.
Yeah, no, it's not as if I ignore those movies I dislike Sean Connery's performances. I think he's doing a great job. And of course, I understand that, my parents and older fans and many fans also my age say, those are actually the better movies, and that is more of a brutal killer figure.
But, by the way, you said better movies. Since I knew we were going to be doing this show, I decided to watch with my wife. We watched in entirety Goldfinger.
Okay.
Because I wanted to see how did that compare after seeing Spectre over the weekend. Because in my mind, I have these old movies,
right,
and they are the kind of the gold standard. And I have to tell you, this there's many scenes, memorable scenes in Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it's, as a movie as a whole, pretty slow.
Really?
Yeah, pretty slow. I mean, there's some real parts there that just kind of really kind of put you to sleep because there's a lot of exposition to get to those interesting scenes.
My memory is that when you watch it, you get the classic cliche of a villain explaining an elaborate plot to a room full of people that he is about to kill immediately after explaining an elaborate plot to them.
Do you remember this scene?
Yes.
You're talking about Goldfinger.
Yeah, I'm feeling tense in a certain part of my anatomy right now. Oh, there it goes. Oh, get that away from me. Let's do theater of the mind.
That's the laser.
An industrial laser, Mr. Bond.
So coming up, this is actually...
This is gold, Mr. Bond.
Oh, yeah.
All my life, I've been in love with its color, its brilliance, its divine heaviness.
I relish any enterprise.
I welcome any enterprise that will increase my stock. Which is considerable.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to die.
Classic.
It's lovely. And I'm also humming along that piece of music. I think that's a great tense piece of score as well.
Oh, yeah,
I love
exactly.
John Barry
exactly.
And the set design, even if you're, you know, I can see the clip that you're playing, but if you're listening and you've seen this, you can remember the design of the room they're in and the gold table Sean Connery's lying on. It's just, to me...
So the villain is key
yes.
To every one of these 24 Bond movies.
Mm-hmm.
I put Goldfinger pretty close to the top.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he's a great villain. The trivia buffs love the fact that that actor's actually dubbed, Gert Frobe. Yeah, as much as we're savoring all of those details and we love the villain and we love the actor, that he's dubbed by someone else. He's a German actor and he wanted work. And they said, well, can you speak English? Can you perform? And he said, yes, you know. And then found out that his English wasn't good enough. And they
that's
had to
a little known fact.
Yeah, that's fun. I mean, again, there's that sense of, you know, loving the trivia detail.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I have participated in James Bond trivia contests here and there, and I've been humbled. You know, there are people who are really precise about the amount of knowledge that they have. They love the lore and the little facts.
Well, do you have a favorite villain at all?
I mean, I do think Goldfinger is quite strong, and I'm saddened to hear that it doesn't hold up on a repeat viewing for you. But it's interesting that, you know, you watched Spectre and then you went back to Goldfinger, because to me, Goldfinger is a movie of so many iconic, spectacular moments, and they're singular and specific and unique in a way that Spectre, I don't think, quite gets to. Spectre is never dull. But its highs are never as high as Goldfinger. And I feel like I err on that side. I'd rather a movie that takes its time and slows down and maybe even, you know, potentially, I don't want to use the word boring, but, you know, approaches it in order to build to the truly creative and unique bits.
So what villain for you had creative bits that you really enjoyed? Other than the Goldfinger character and...
I enjoy the rivalry between Roger Moore and Christopher Lee in The Man with the Golden Gun.
Okay.
I think that's a good example of somebody, you know, Scaramanga, this assassin that has a personal connection with the James Bond character, but also, you know, has to kill him, or wants to at least. And I love, you know, Christopher Lee, I think, is just a wonderful, dry actor and is a nice counterpoint to Roger Moore's kind of... I don't want to say fruitier, but in the sense of, you know, wine tasting tones, that Christopher Lee is more dry and that Roger Moore is a bit more ripe, you know, that those guys play off of each other pretty well. But again, you know,
again, like you said, it's like talking about baseball statistics.
Right.
And for me, I like Javier Bardem if we're looking at recent villains.
Yeah.
But who played Silva in Skyfall.
Right. He's got a great introduction scene in that movie, delivering a monologue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And legend has it that they built the set of that room to accommodate the length of the monologue. that they wrote.
Go ahead. For people who haven't seen it, the most have made $1 billion. But go ahead and describe that scene.
Well, the villain is introduced. We wait for him. It's about an hour into the film.
Yes.
And again, like Goldfinger, there's that sense of, well, we'll delay for a while. You know, right. we're gonna play with you a little bit. And then he's introduced in a very large room on a private island of, I believe, ruined architecture. And he descends, he arrives in a descending elevator, exits, and walks towards James Bond at the other end of the room, and gives a speech about his island and his mother's island growing up, her own small island, that had a rat infestation, and how the way you get rats to leave an island is to get them to turn on each other and make them consume one another. And isn't that equivalent to you and me, that we are the last two rats of the 00 agency? And he gives this chilling monologue walking directly to camera, and apparently they built the room so that Javier Bardem could time his walk so that it would accommodate the exact duration of
the room itself is as long as a football field.
Yeah.
It just goes forever.
Right. It's this tiny, tiny figure getting bigger and bigger and ever creepier. And again, I don't think Spectre has as strong an introduction for Christoph Waltz, you know, that it seems like a film that is trying to find ways to top the last one, and I don't know that it ever quite reaches them. It's putting strenuous effort into it. It's filled with action and size and spectacle, but I don't know that it has the lightness and the creativity and the true, specific, unique surrealism of the best James Bond films.
Bond girls,
mm-hmm.
And we can talk a little bit about that now. Help me this. You like the Roger Moore series?
Yeah, I can't help but do
who are the memorable Bond girls in that? So Christopher Lee's a memorable villain.
Yeah.
In terms of Bond girls,
I would probably say that the most memorable is in The Spy Who Loved Me, that he's got a genuine romance with a peer rather than a sex object. And in The Spy Who Loved Me, he's playing, the character is set up against a female Russian agent, Anya Amasova, played by Barbara Bach,
Ringo Starr's wife. Okay,
right.
Yes.
And so
yes.
The two of them get to have a little bit more screwball comedy banter between them.
Right, right, right. They're kind of on equal footing.
Right,
right, right, right.
And it's, you know, there's a lot of play, but it also has the subplot about James Bond killing in self-defense her lover during the opening credit sequence. And then the movie gives Roger Moore a genuinely good acting scene in which she confronts him about this. And he says, in our job, people get killed.
Hmm.
You know it. He knew it. I know it. The answer to your question is yes, I did kill him. You know, and then in the midst of all of this banter, she says, when this mission is over, I will kill you. And so we get this extra tension, even though we've been in this world of silliness and fantasy, there is this reminder that the stakes are important. And again, it's still kind of performative, even though it's intense and Roger Moore gets a dramatic scene, it still fits within the formula of a fantasy trip or vacation or lifestyle where, you know, I think, I don't know if this applies to you, but I think it does for many of us. We go on vacations and nothing really happens. You know, you sit around and yes, you enjoy relaxing, but there's the sense of, wouldn't it be nice if something actually happened on this trip? I met someone, I got involved in intrigue, you know, I got involved in a plot, and to me it's almost like a chicken and egg question where perhaps it's the James Bond movies themselves that have planted that in me, that when you go to an exotic location, something should happen to you there, and that's why vacations seem disappointing. Or if the suggestion is you're going to take an exciting trip, and on these trips, important events will happen to you. You will meet women that you have meaningful relationships with. You will meet people that are important to you and confront you. You know, it's an interesting kind of chicken or egg. You know,
if you're Bond, they may die, but
most likely
there's that.
Yeah, yeah, most likely.
When did the names start to change for the Bond girls? I mean, the early ones, Dr. No, Honey Rider,
mm-hmm.
and then Goldfinger, Pussy Galore,
right?
Who, by the way, was his equal too.
Right,
she could fly an airplane. She knew judo. She also was a little bit older. She was 38 years old. Honor Blackman is what I'm talking about right now at the time. But the names were, when did that shift start to change where they didn't have kind of what, for sake of a better word, kind of a porn name?
Yeah.
When did this start to change?
Well, are you asking when they decided to try to get away from the pornographic names?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when did that shift? Did that occur during the Roger Moore series then?
Yeah, I mean, so, I think some people would say that Roger Moore might be the most pornographic era. You know, he has a character in Moonraker called Holly Goodhead. And it gives me a perverse pleasure to feel that, to say that name on the radio over public broadcast, as if I'm getting away with something. And I think that's, I think that actually, you know,
and that's something too, because those names were pretty outrageous back then.
Right. I mean, after Moonraker, he makes a movie called Octopussy.
Yes, exactly.
And so, you know, I cracked a silly joke a moment ago about feeling like I'm getting away with something, saying these words over the public air.
Exactly.
And I think that's, I think that's not, in some, it's a joke and it isn't, because I think that was exactly the point of doing it, is that the movie gives, the movies, and Ian Fleming, the author, creates just enough narrative context to allow you to get away with saying pussy galore. And it reminds you that there is a kind of childishness to the series. That I was at a conference once and we were talking about the movies, and I said, you know, really, the James Bond movies are a child's idea of an adult movie. They're what a child thinks a grown-up movie should be like. They're, you know, well, I guess there will be lots of women and smooching, and then there will be shooting, and, you know, the child doesn't necessarily understand the plots, and often the movies themselves don't seem to. But the movies say, well, now we need to be over here doing this just because we need to blow up this big base, etc. But there's that sense of watching them as an adult, you get the comfort of childish pleasures. That there's a kind of a childish and an adolescent smuttiness to saying Holly Goodhead on the radio and knowing that the FCC can't touch us. It was established. It was, you know, I was just, that's just her name. I'm allowed to say Goodhead as much as I want.
Well, I am talking to Chris Cooling.
Yes.
And film professor at the College of Lake County. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Chris regarding the cultural trends of the James Bond series. And we'll take a peek at the latest 007 movie, Spectre. You're listening to Word of Mouth, and we'll be back right after this.
A cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. But don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. The kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. The kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He loves gold. He loves only gold. Only gold. He loves gold.
Wow. Shirley Bassey, yeah, Goldfinger, and I tell you, she just belts it out, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just
they brought her back for other songs.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Moonraker and Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Are Forever. I almost started singing it, but no one can sing like Shirley Bassey.
Mm-hmm. We may try later in the show, but we will fail.
You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. If you just joined us, we've been discussing all things James Bond, really, and maybe not all things, because 53 years is hard to get through.
There's a lot to get to.
Starting with Dr. No in 1962 and the recent release of Spectre. Maybe we should get a little bit into this, Chris. Has the series, we talked a little bit about this before we broke. We were talking about some of the Bond girls' names,
right,
such as Pussy Galore and that type of thing. And you don't see those names anymore. I don't think as frequently. I was kind of checking it out in Spectre. But going along with that, maybe this is the segue too. How has the series adapted to cultural trends in these 53 years that the series has been going on?
Well, it's a good question, and I think, you know, there are plenty of people that would suggest that it hasn't, or that it hasn't done it quickly enough,
mm-hmm,
and that in many ways it is still inherently, you know, conservative and backwards looking.
Maybe that's a better question. How hasn't?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that when you go back to the first appearance of Pierce Brosnan in 1995.
We haven't mentioned him.
That's true.
The whole segment, we just ignored him.
And okay. I feel like that's, you know, that's right.
Okay. Here we go with our statistics again, with Bond films, funny, and Bond actors.
I always found him to be a little bit of a lightweight and a bit plain. And, you know, with Roger Moore, people are not in the mood for him, but he's specific. You know, like, love him or hate him, he's doing something very precise. He's doing something of his own. And with Pierce Brosnan, I just got the sense of, you know, a generic James Bond.
Remington Steele goes to England.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they establish his female boss. They cast Judi Dench to play M. Judi Dench. Mm-hmm. What did I say? Judi Dench to play M. And she has dialogue saying to him, you know, I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur. And I've always assumed there was a bit of redundancy in sexism and misogyny, but it's right there in the line. And, you know, I found myself saying, you know, he's also a racist dinosaur. You didn't mention that. And that there's the sense that all of these movies are kind of coming from a legacy of British imperialism fighting for its life. You know, you go back to the novels appear, the first one's written in 1952 and is published in 53.
And you're talking about the author, Ian
Fleming. Okay. Yeah, Casino Royale is published in 53.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these aren't completely my points. There's a great book out there called The Man Who Saved Britain. By Simon Winder, about James Bond coming out of this troubling cultural moment for Britain, losing its way after the Second World War, struggling to rebuild economically, the rise of the Labour Party wanting to give voice to the working man. You know, you think about other British films of the 60s, and they're all Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Look Back in Anger. They're all the angry young man, kitchen sink realism. And so there's this split of, we need to be really self-aware of how we're going to rebuild as a nation. And then there's a suggestion that James Bond is almost an alternate timeline fantasy in which Britain is still a world power and still has access to its colonies.
That's a very good point.
Britain's losing
India. You have
the
feeling when you're watching a Bond movie, it's all things London, all things England, Great Britain. Good point. Yeah.
Everything radiates out from it.
Yeah.
But James Bond is going to be going to places like India. He's going to be going to places like Jamaica, mm-hmm, places that are losing their British rule. Hmm. And so the movies are, again, a kind of alternate universe in which Britain still has a lot to do with these places and still matters. You know, Britain loses India in 1947 after the war is over. And for a lot of people, you know, that's a huge crushing. That's an existential disappointment that, you know, the sun does now set on the British Empire, where it used to not. It used to be that the British Empire spanned so much of the world that there was literally no sunset for it, and now it's not the case. And so there's, for a lot of people, the suggestion that James Bond is this therapeutic fantasy. What you want in reality, you can no longer get. These realities don't exist. And so there's this question of how the series will grow by including people. You know, is this just going to be a fantasy for white heterosexual men who either are British or respect Britishness or wish they were British, they, you know, respect tradition? And that's, I think, part of why I like Roger Moore and the is because he reminds us that this is all of a joke. This is all, this is all a kind of desperate, sad joke, and that for me, Roger Moore presents the irony of it, whereas Sean Connery is so brutal about it. And you know, in particular, I've known interviews with him where he talks about his own attitudes towards women, and they're pretty retrograde. There's a famous anecdote that I'll tell. In 1987, Sean Connery is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for The Untouchables, and so is Albert Brooks for Broadcast News, Best Supporting Actor. And Albert Brooks says, well, there's no way they're going to give it to Sean Connery. They love Sean Connery. They don't love Albert Brooks. I'm not going to get it. And then Sean Connery gives an interview with Barbara Walters where he talks about his comfort with beating women, where he says, well, I think there are some women who, if they don't give you a chance to say your piece, you know, you give them the back of your hand. And then Albert Brooks hears this interview and says, great, I'm going to win, Sean Connery. And then Sean Connery wins anyway. You know, that Sean Connery's legacy is so powerful that he can kind of get away with this. And that, as much as we talk about James Bond and you and I have fun doing it, we also have to acknowledge that some people feel excluded by it, there isn't necessarily room for them to enjoy this fantasy. And there's a sense in which the series still has room to grow in terms of how it handles gender, how it handles race, and how it engages with current events.
Well, the big news was that one of the Bond girls who's in Spectre was 51 years old.
Right. Right.
And why that should even be that we're even talking about it is sort of interesting, too. But that was a breakthrough of sorts, I guess.
Right. You know? Right. Again,
and 51 isn't all that old. So
And again, she's a beautiful, desirable woman who has been beautiful and desirable, Monica Bellucci, across many movies for quite some time. And yes, is age appropriate. And technically, I mean, I think that's a nice example of a talking point that the media gives out. You know, the actress Maude Adams is close to Roger Moore's age when they appear in Octopussy in 1983. And so I suppose that's been done, having the actors be relatively close in age. I think
We talked about Honor Blackman, who played
a little bit older.
She was 38. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, if I wanted to imagine how a series looks forward and truly adapts to the times, I find myself thinking back on how recently people have talked about whether the actor Idris Elba would take the role, the black actor from Luther, who appears in Prometheus and who's an incredible actor and would do a great job of it.
So we're talking about the future Bonds,
right?
Okay.
You know, some people have suggested that this will be Daniel Craig's last film. It seems like, you know, coming to a close at the end of Spectre. And so will we get a black James Bond going forward? And the series is, you know, fundamentally conservative in some ways.
Well, they've talked about a female James Bond, too.
Right.
Jamie Bond or whatever. But that's also been part of the dialogue.
Right. And I would say I am confident that in my lifetime we will see a black James Bond, and it will be a good thing for the series. I think the sooner the better. And I think doing that would give the series, again, more weight and context, more weight and content, that you've got a black spy traveling the world enforcing the rule of Britain or enforcing its government and its policies, and now you can have you can have villains genuinely saying, why are you loyal to this?
You mentioned Spectre.
Yes.
We haven't really talked about the most recent one, and probably very few people have seen it because it just came out over the weekend.
Yes, I won't spoil anything.
That was sort of my spoiler alert thing.
Yeah,
but we can kind of talk around it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it did make $70.4 million, I think it was, over the weekend. Not quite as much as Skyfall did.
Right.
And which has been a talking point in the press.
That's
a heck of a weekend, though, I'll tell you, for box office.
It will still make a lot of money.
So,
and has already.
Yeah. So the latest film, Spectre, is pretty much, I think it's very topical.
Okay.
It's about the information age. Everyone's on the grid.
That it is.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
It tells you that it is.
Okay.
Right? But again, for me, that's the kind of problem of asking the question is how does it keep up with the times? I don't think it does that good a job of it, and particularly I don't think it does that good a job of it talking about actual threats around the world, right? That the things that are on our mind, you know, have a lot to do with ISIS in the Middle East, and that's the type of subject matter that is too sensitive for, that's too sensitive for the fantastic fantasy world, the therapeutic fantasies of James Bond movies. And so their topicality, I think, comes more with the movies they're ripping off, or the other movies that they're engaging in a dialogue with. So their topicality is, let's be more like Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. Let's be more like a kung fu movie. Let's be more like a blaxploitation movie. But Spectre is a movie that establishes a kind of global, worldwide net of espionage information that villains want to control. But this is what's given me trouble with Spectre and Skyfall, is that both of those things are given the merest glancing of lip service.
How so?
In favor of stories that are really about how this affects James Bond, the person. The villains in the last two movies have been more interested in, I want to hurt you, James Bond. I want to kill your female boss. I want to cause you pain. And for me, the result is a movie that I have trouble connecting with, because I don't see a hero who's trying to save the world. I don't see a hero who's trying to save immediate human lives in danger. And instead, there are these abstract nods towards, if James Bond doesn't do this in time, the villains will have access to all information everywhere around the world. And they seem to have that already. I mean, at one point
just
see...
Just go on Facebook, right?
Yeah, well, at one point you see the villains show James Bond video footage of everything that's already happened to him throughout the whole movie.
Right.
And we might say, yeah, what's left for you to gain? You already have all of this. And so to me, it seems like an abstract way of saying, oh, wasn't that topical? That reminds me of Edward Snowden. When really the movie doesn't have any interest in it. It has an interest in making you think that it's keeping up with the times, but really it's showing off all of the old-fashioned things. There's another ejector seat in the movie. There's another Aston Martin.
Well, there's a tip of the hat to Goldfinger, I think, right. in Spectre.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminded me of the old films from the 60s. We didn't have to worry about backstories, about people's boyhood and that type of thing. And that to me sometimes gets a little tiresome, as it did in Skyfall. I know $1 billion, everybody loved it.
Not me.
Okay. Well, yeah. Here's something we agree on.
Yeah, we have similar problems with it.
Yeah, but Spectre just was like the old-fashioned Bond movies and just kept you at the edge of your seat.
Yeah. I mean, I will say it's smothered in action, and some of the action sequences are well done. I don't think any of the action sequences are as strong as the first 15 minutes of Skyfall. I think Skyfall begins with quite a strong action sequence and then rolls a bit downhill from there. And I think for me, part of the problem is the director. Sam Mendes is a kind of middlebrow prestige director who makes, you know, movies that announce themselves as important works of art. But
American Beauty.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's amazing that that's the same director
right.
who did American Beauty and now did Skyfall and Spectre.
Well, wow. But you know what? I see the commonalities of them, because I think American Beauty is also overrated and announces itself as much more important and full of content than it is. I think it announces itself.
Don't hold back, Chris.
Yeah, no. Okay, yeah, well, yeah. I mean, let me ask an honest question. Have you gone back and looked at it?
American Beauty?
Since 1999?
I have not. What? Maybe a few years ago. I might have, right. you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But does it hold up well? I don't know.
I don't think it would. Okay. And I think it's revealing that you haven't gone back to it. I don't think any of us want to. I think there are other movies from 1999 and beyond, you know, movies that like maybe the Coen brothers or Quentin Tarantino might have made that are specific, but that Sam Mendes makes movies that at the time seem a lot more meaningful than they are. The Oscars do that a lot. You know, if you go back and look at the Oscars, you'll say, gosh, we gave the Oscar to that. We gave the Oscar to Dances with Wolves when we should have given it to Goodfellas. Everybody goes back and watches Goodfellas again, and nobody goes back to Dances with Wolves. But we were suckered at the time by the appearance of respectability. And I think Sam Mendes traffics in that.
Now, everybody does go back to Daniel Craig.
Yes.
And my question is, what makes him so appealing? I think we touched a little bit on it, but there's something there. My sister, who's 71 years old, we were watching the film in New Mexico.
Yes.
And she said, oh, I love this Bond.
Yes, so do I.
And she said, I love this movie. And I think it was because of Daniel Craig.
Right.
And he's not as attractive as a Roger Moore.
Right, no.
So anyway, what is his appeal?
He's a human being. I mean, he's a genuinely great actor. As I've said, after I saw Casino Royale, I said to myself, this is the first time I've seen a James Bond movie where the most interesting part of the James Bond movie is the performance of the actor playing James Bond. Most James Bond movies have generic performances, or, you know, where the memorable bits are the surreal sets and action sequences and villains. But he's the center of that movie and merits it, and rewrites the series and says the series should be about this human being and getting to know him. And I think that there's been an interesting project over his four movies of asking ourselves gradually, the filmmakers and producers saying, well, now what do we do with him? What would a Daniel Craig James Bond movie look like if we put him into You Only Live Twice or Goldfinger?
Exactly. Interesting.
And I think that, I don't think they found an interesting answer to the question. I think that Spectre just physically places him inside the action sequences, but I think the movie is a tragic waste of Daniel Craig. I don't think he has any good scenes or memorable moments. The movie's in such a hurry to get to the next bit of plot and action that we're squandering this incredible actor who really reinvigorated the series back in the first couple of movies.
Can I be a little glib here?
Sure.
Did they waste the talent of henchman David Bautista?
I think they got exactly what they wanted from
right.
him.
You He's know. No odd job.
Yeah.
Sure miss odd job from Goldfinger, where henchmen were kind of interesting.
Yeah.
They had a top hat to kill.
Right. Well, the thing about this one is just the fact that there is a henchman at all in the movie. Right? We haven't had one in a while. We've had various intense people that will fight with James Bond and try and beat him up, but we won't have that sense of the iconic. How can we try to manufacture the iconic? And I think that's what Spectre is struggling with throughout, is trying to create something that's equal to those wonderful, surreal, singular images while doing so in a generic way and squandering the true singular talents of the actors in the film.
I am talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about James Bond.
Ooh.
Was an open book. You used to say, live and let live.
You know you did.
But if this ever changes, we live in makes you give in and cry. Say, live and let die.
That's music from Live and Let Die.
Mm-hmm. How can we forget?
Paul McCartney and Wings. And if you're just joining us, my name's Jim Wunderlich. You're listening to Word of Mouth. And my guest today is Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. And we have been talking about all things Bond. And my gosh, we've talked about British imperialism.
Yes, you have to.
And the names, the many names that come along in the Bond girls' names, and names that you wouldn't think you could say on the radio, but we did.
I know, the childish glee.
And we talked a lot about the cultural trends, too, with James Bond and Spectre as well. And Chris, what do you think's next for James Bond in the next, what do you foresee?
I have my fantasy versions. I suspect that, you know, in reality, they're going to keep doubling down on what they've been doing. I would love to see Idris Elba or, you know, an African, not African American, but a black actor in the role. If I had to pick a kind of ideal future direction, if they gave me $1 billion and said, you know, re-energize the series, I would take all of that money and give it to Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men.
Hmm.
I would say, you understand the 60s, you understand the period detail, you understand the surrealism of being masculine in this era and trying to hold on to these tropes that are slipping away, these cliches that don't mean anything. And you fought the gender wars well. You knew how to, you know, depict those stakes. I would love to see a James Bond film set in the 60s again and kind of almost, you know, in the same way that Casino Royale went back to the beginning and went back to the first novel. It would be interesting to go back to the era and depict it with a bit more complexity than the films originally did and say, could we rewrite them? There are many novels that have never been truly adapted. We've taken the titles and we've picked pieces here and there, but it might be interesting to genuinely reboot the series and tell the stories of the novels and find ways to update them more progressively.
I think that's really a great idea. Let's go back to the 60s. Let's return to where we were.
But you know,
and maybe they can if they do have a new Bond,
right?
And then who knows? Might even have a new female Bond too, and the whole thing could change.
An equivalent,
paradigm, you know?
Right? But then, of course, people have had that idea and tried it with The Man from U.N.C.L.E. This past summer came out and was set in the era, and it wasn't a huge hit. The Avengers was a British TV show that did have a kind of female James Bond and Emma Peel, and the film version of that was disastrous. So, unfortunately, as much as I love the series, if we're going to look for that type of progress, they had such a great amount of progress with Daniel Craig and his first two movies, and now they seem a little hesitant and tentative again. They will change, but they will do so slowly, gradually, over a long period of time.
So what's next for Chris Cooling?
Oh, thank you for asking. I'm going to be showing another film for my international film series at CLC. You can Google us for CLC International Film Series, and you will learn about our screening of Ida, the Polish Oscar winner for Best Foreign Language Film. It was also nominated for cinematography. It's absolutely gorgeous. And we generally show our films on the first Friday of the month during the semester. So before each semester.
We can look forward to that.
Please do. Please come out. I hope to see you.
Chris, thanks again for being on the program today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And if you wish to contact Chris Cooling, you can go to the CLC website as well, and that is www.clcillinois.edu. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 3 p.m. when I talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.